Hello, and welcome to Game of Groans, the podcast where I, Emily Bateman, finally start watching Game of Thrones to see what all the fuss is about. I wanted to thank everyone for supporting me in my schedule change and still actually listening. I know I took a long break, but I am back and ready to go. Also, I wanted to say a special shout out to all of my international listeners. I see you guys, and I am very thankful that you're listening. Lastly, if any of you guys feel like being generous and leaving a review, I would really appreciate it. Today, I have fellow podcaster Chris Heck on with me to discuss episode 2 of season 2, The Nightlands. So let's get into it. So today I'm discussing season 2, episode 2, The Nightlands, and I have Chris Heck to do it with me today. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. Excited to be on.
I'm glad. So, since this is your first time on this podcast, I wanted to ask your relationship with the show, how you started watching it, when, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I definitely turned into a super fan, but when I first came into the material, I had no idea what Game of Thrones was, but I'm a big HBO guy. I follow a lot of the different shows, and I've never really forgotten the fact that I was watching the end of True Blood, and they were getting ready to wrap all that up, and then they started running trailers for this new show, Game of Thrones, and it just completely caught my attention, you know, the fantasy aspects. I think they showed some of the very first episode, the pilot episode, where you see the White Walkers, so how could you not get sucked into that, right? Mm-hmm. So I marked my calendar, you know, watched the first season as it came out. As soon as the first season ended, I immediately ordered all the books and went on a 6-month tear where I couldn't put them down, and I was just hooked. So from then, I've been a complete George R.R. Martin fan and Game of Thrones fan, and I've probably seen the series, you know, at least 3 or 4 times over, watching it with different folks, but I fell in love.
That's awesome. And so you, a lot of people that I talk to, like, they're, oh, this is my first time rewatching it. So you have watched it multiple times and are very familiar with, especially the books and also the TV show.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just one of those people that by the nature of how it happened, I kind of adapted to it or adopted it early. And then, you know, I kept selling it to all my friends. Oh, my gosh, you've got to watch this crazy show. There's so much going on. There's dragons, you know. And so as I started, you know, back when you would buy DVDs and that was a thing, you know, I would get the box set when they would come out. And then it was like, oh, you know, my new girlfriend, you got to watch this show. Let's watch it. My best friend, you got to watch this. And I would watch it with them. And so I got a couple initial, you know, rewatches in. And then before the final season came out this past year, I did one big rewatch where I went, you know, end to end and kind of refreshed for the end of it. But this was great because this gave me a reason to go back. I hadn't watched it in a few months. And so I was excited to go back and see what happened in season 2, episode 2.
Yes. Yeah. A little random, but yeah, it's fun to look back at things. I think with especially a more maybe analytical eye than you have in the past.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. And, you know, really just focusing in on one episode versus I'm going to blitz through this whole season or, you know, just put it on in the background. It kind of gave me a different perspective watching through it.
Nice. Well, I guess we'll just kind of get into it. There's always so much to talk about.
Yeah, they're packed episodes every time.
Every time. So many scenes, so much to do. So we start with the caravan that's going to the Night Watch, and you see Arya hiding in the river peeing because she's pretending to be a boy.
Yep, she's doing her best.
Yeah, she did all right. It was really tense for like 2 seconds. And then she's coming back to their camp and she walks by these men as part of the group, but they're in cages or a cage. There's 3 men in a cage. And one guy is like talking to her, but he's talking about himself in the third person. Like, what's up with them? Because we don't see them again.
Yeah, Jaqen H'ghar, I don't know if you caught his name, but he did mention it there, and he's just a ball of mystery, right? You look at him, and you kind of think between him and the other two that one of these is definitely not like the other, and so you've got kind of pretty boy Jaqen H'ghar there, and then these two just vicious criminals scaring everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So then it makes you think, well, if he's in with those two guys, what the hell has he done or is going to do that, like, makes him just as bad as them? Because the other guy just, like, yells at Arya, and then she smacks him, which is awesome.
She always fights back. Well, and it kind of puts it in perspective, right? You said about the danger, because, you know, everybody that goes to the Night's Watch is some sort of criminal or somebody that's, you know, lost their honor, lost their titles, whatever it may be. And so why are these three separated from the rest of that otherwise, you know, terrible group?
Yeah, so weird. Like, the only thing I could think of was, like, cannibals, but why would they take them to the Night's Watch if they're, like, why would they take them and keep them in cages? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well, they'll take anybody. I know that they've always been a desperate faction, so I guess they don't have the luxury of choosing which fighters they take or not.
That is a good point, as we see later on in the episode when they're asking for more men. So then Gendry appears and says that those guys scare him, but Arya's like, I'm not scared of anything because I'm like a 12-year-old girl.
Oh, she's full of confidence.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And so then the gold cloaks appear, which Arya thinks they're looking for her, but twist, they're looking for Gendry, and even though they don't get to take him because Yoren threatens them, they still say out loud what they're looking for, so everybody, like, awkwardly knows that he's being hunted, essentially.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't help but sit and just wonder to myself, like, could you just imagine being someone like Gendry and having no clue that you have so much value and position in the world? Like, you've been essentially a gutter rat, you know, growing up in Flea Bottom, slaved out to this blacksmith, you know, doing whatever he wants. And then all of a sudden these royal people come up and they're like, we want you, bro.
Yeah. And very specifically, and but he doesn't seem to be, like, really bothered. He's just like, whatever, this is weird. I'm doing what I'm doing. So, okay.
It's true. Well, he might have some idea, I guess, because he did go on to mention about how the Hand of the King had come and talked to him. And, you know, so he knows that there's something up, but I don't think he really has any actual clue. I definitely don't think he expected the gold cloaks to come looking for him.
Oh, yeah. No, I think he definitely believed Arya as well when she said that they're looking for her. And he's like, oh, well, okay, you know, that's fine. Oh, wait, it's me. So I was worried, honestly, later on, because when they said there was a reward, that one of the other people in, like, the party were going to do something. But so far, nobody's really fucked with Gendry, so I'm interested to see what happens.
Well, I don't know if anybody would mess with Yoren, you know, because some of the characters like Yoren, you only see a little bit of here and there, but I always like when they show him because he's definitely one of those guys, you know, the Night's Watch definitely has some folks that are badass and they still have a ton of honor. And if you think about how much he was willing to give up right there in defense of really all he knew was Arya that he had in his possession. But even as little as he actually probably owes her, you know, he's right there, boom, puts the knife to the guy's leg, you know, threatens to kill him and is just going to go to the teeth to take care of his people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was really impressed with him again. And he just kind of appears sometimes and I kind of forgot what he looked like. And I was like, oh, yeah, like he's a real cool guy. And he's just kind of appeared in and out of the whole season. And then now this new season, I really like him a lot. He's cool. So then we go to King's Landing and you've got the ever whistling Tyrion, which I adore. And he's going into his room to find Shay is talking to Varys, which, what the fuck? This is terrible.
Yeah, it definitely shocks Tyrion. He was not expecting anybody to, I think, be talking to Shay so soon.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I think, was it, and maybe it's the last episode, he's like, no one can know you're here. Like, literally, you cannot be seen. And then the next time we see her, like, she's laughing and talking with this guy who has a lot of power. And Tyrion's like, oh my gosh, why are you doing this? What is happening?
Yep. Yeah, I really like this scene because even though it seems like kind of a throwaway scene or a passerby, it really starts to set up the rivalry between Tyrion and Varys. And, you know, you have two of the smartest characters, I think, that you see in the whole series here. So they're the wit between the two and the dialogue that was written for them is very off the nose. You know, it's almost like they're talking in code, but they both are hearing each other. And so I always really like these kinds of moments kind of throughout the whole Game of Thrones, but especially when you get characters like Tyrion and Varys together, because I feel like they're just kind of on a level above most everybody else.
Yeah, I really honestly didn't put them together as like being competitive when Tyrion, it was decided that he was going back to King's Landing, but it totally makes sense, this matchup, in addition to Varys and Littlefinger as that own mashup. Like those three are definitely like some of the smartest and also like vying for whatever information. And even Tyrion says, you know, I'm not a man of honor, even though the last hand was. Yep. Like, I'm not, so you don't fuck with me.
Yeah, he definitely stands up to his threats, you know, and then Varys comes back and pretty much says, well, you can try to kill me if you want, but nobody else has been successful, you know.
I know. I was concerned. I really, normally it starts with one person threatens and then the other one does and they back down, but this is very back and forth, so I'm worried.
Yeah. Well, and the thing with Tyrion is obviously now that he's Hand of the King, he's got a higher status than he's ever had. You know, really the best thing going for him up until this point was that he was his last name, right? The fact that he was mm-hmm. a Lannister. But you can tell that he was smart. He watched his dad. He's watched his family members, you know, rule Casterly Rock or rule from King's Landing. He knows how the Game of Thrones is played. And, you know, right here, you immediately see him go toe-to-toe with, you know, somebody who's now made it through, what, three or four kingships in mm-hmm. Varys. And so I just, these are the kind of moments for me, especially after reading the books, that I always liked. You know, everybody gravitates to the action and this and that, but I like these types of like high dialogue moments.
Oh yeah, I think some of my favorite parts are interesting conversations between characters. Yeah, the action usually is very gory and jarring for me, so I mean, I'm a little used to it, but I definitely say the conversations are I enjoy them more than just running around or that kind of thing. So yeah, it could be seen as a throwaway, but I think you're right. It's important. It sets up a new relationship that you hadn't seen before, which is between Varys and Tyrion. And we'll just see where it goes while both of them are at King's Landing.
Yeah. And it's wild because, you know, some of these characters, they need each other so much. Right. You know, you think about like a government or a ruling class, you know, like they all still need to work together, but then just everybody is so cutthroat. And we start to really see some of that come to light, you know, here in season two.
Oh, yeah. True. I can't think of the right word.
True motivations and like faces have been shown throughout the season so far, where a lot of people have been putting up facades, which meant you weren't sure if you had seen the real person yet. So then we're still in King's Landing, but we go to Cersei reading Robb's peace treaty, and she just immediately tears it up. Then she asks about Jaime, and he's like, oh, I've seen him. And she's like, well, tell him I said hi, basically.
Yeah, it was interesting because you see, like, they're in a small council meeting. So this is official, you know, Westerosi business. They're getting, you know, peace deals for the war that they're in. So it's extremely important matters that they're talking about. And Cersei's just like, tell me about Jaime. Is he doing okay? Is he still pretty? Has he got his blonde hair, you know?
Absolutely. You could see it in her face. She's just like, did you talk to him? Did he ask about me?
Yeah, did he ask about me? I know he's a prisoner of war, but like, was he better have asked about me?
Emphasizes all the rumors that have been swirling about them. And she's just like, I don't care. I'm going to do what I want. And then they also get a raven from the wall, which is the one saying that the wildlings are starting to organize. And there's the blue zombies and people are coming back from the dead. Because this is from Commander Mormont. And Tyrion's like, oh, no, this is true. He doesn't lie. And they're like, you're dumb. What a liar. You're so superstitious. And we are not sending people over to help them.
Yeah, Cersei asks Tyr, she accuses Tyrion of essentially believing in, quote, grumpkins and snarks.
What is that?
After his trip to the wall. Yeah, I think from the books, it's just one of those terms that popped up here and there, you know, instead of ghosts and goblins or things like that. It was just the terminology that they use in that. But yeah, Cersei completely laughs it off. And obviously it sounds ridiculous, right? Like, zombie apocalypse? What are you talking about, Tyrion, you know? But at the same time, like, those are two very big threats, and they just don't even have the ability to take it seriously right now because of the fact that they've got all these other wars, they've got all these other problems. Jaime's captured, like we talked about, you know, so they kind of just walk away from it.
So then we go back to the Night's Watch party. Now we go to the party that's behind the wall with Jon Snow and the people that are already part of the Night's Watch. So there's two different, technically, Night Watch parties, I guess.
Yeah, we were talking about soon-to-be-initiated Night's Watch folks, and now we're up looking at the people that have already taken their vows and are defending the realm.
Yes, exactly. So you see Sam talking to some other guys because they're still at Caster's like little hut house, whatever.
Yep.
And I'm getting real bad vibes about Sam because he's like real horny. I'm like, what is going on?
There's so many women everywhere.
I know. And it's not fair. Like, he's so greedy. I'm like, dude, just be chill. But he isn't, because Ghost tries to steal food from some woman and Sam like shoos him away. And literally in my notes, I said, oh, this will be rich. And of course, like, he makes sure she isn't hurt. And she's like, you're so brave. And I was like, oh, no, this is the kiss of death.
Oh, he's going to be hooked. You know, no guy with that level of experience, you know, can have any girl talk to him and not be immediately hooked. And it's not really any easier for him, right? Because when the scene opened, you've got Pip and Meryn and him, and they're literally sharing stories about becoming men. When it comes to that aspect of life, as you know, Pip's talking about wrestling around with the farm girl, and I think Sam's just like, "I wish I grew up on a farm."
I know. He was like, how many times? And the guy was like, I didn't count like as many as I tried. Because obviously Sam would be counting because he's at zero right now. And I was like, oh no.
Yeah, he wants the hot gossip. But you know what I liked about what happens here with Sam is, at least, you know, you start to see that he has certain things in him, you know, to step out of the character we've seen so far. Like when he goes and talks to the girl or confronts Ghost, you know, those are all kind of things that are very anti-Sam up until this point. And so it's like baby steps with him.
No, that's very true. Yeah, I think because he's familiar with Ghost, I kind of overlooked it. But you're right. I think if, you know, that he had seen Ghost the first day he was there, he would have been just as afraid as that woman. So, yeah, he is progressing. And I'm glad they let him be on the wall, because I really thought he was going to get left behind.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, in a world that, like, as vicious as, you know, Westeros and the whole Game of Thrones realm, you would think that folks like Sam are just not going to make it. You know, they're going to be Darwinism at its finest, you know, and he's just going to be dead. But he has a knack for survival.
Yeah, he's doing well, and he's making connections with the right people. Because he takes the woman over to John and introduces her as her name is Gilly, and John is like pissed to the max. He's like, hi, what the fuck are you doing? Why is this happening? And he's like, no. And then you find out that she's pregnant and Sam wants to help her and take her with them, which John is like, this doesn't make sense. And he's like, why are you afraid? And so she says, you know, I'm worried about having a boy. And then he's like, well, like, what happens? And this is what they said last episode. I wonder what happens to the boys.
Yep.
But she won't tell him. And he's like, I can't trust you, so we're not taking you.
Right. Yeah. I love John's face when Sam first brings Gilly over, because he's just like, what is going on here, bro? And he's already in the doghouse, right? Because in episode one, you know, he got into it with Craster and he got into it with Lord Mormont. So he's just trying to, you know, chill. You see him, he's just like, I'm just going to sit here and sharpen this sword and do nothing else. I'm not looking at anybody.
Yes, exactly. He's like, you're doing exactly what I just got in trouble for.
And then it was the right call, you know. He tried to get a little bit more information out of her, and she didn't give it, so he ultimately stood strong and kind of stuck to his orders.
And he even kind of rationalized it, like, we can't take a woman into more dangerous territory with a baby. And then he tells Sam, you can't deliver a baby. And Sam's like, I could try. And like,
no,
I read a book.
No.
That's not how this works.
Like, you have to be able to do things.
So then, like, Sam pouts away. And I'm like, this isn't the end of that. And it wasn't.
Well, and John's very much about his duty, you know. So anything that kind of jives with that, he tends to push back, just because, you know, he was raised by Ned Stark. It's all honor, it's all duty. And obviously taking one of Craster's wives with them would be the complete opposite of that. And you would think it would be reverse, right? You would almost think that John would be the one trying to cause trouble and Sam would just be sitting on the side cutting potatoes, but kind of throws things on its head here with this scene.
Absolutely.
They're kind of the antithesis of each other, but it's flipped on its head, where Sam's the one standing up for what's right. And John's just like, we can't. This isn't, no matter what's right or wrong, we have orders and we follow them.
So I think that'll be an interesting, I mean, I love their relationship anyway, but I think it's an interesting progression in their relationship.
Okay, so then we go to, I guess Daenerys's camp. Like, it's kind of, I think Jorah called it a Khalasar later or in the scene even, but I don't know if I would really consider it one because she's not a Dothraki.
It's very desperate times for Khaleesi.
Oh my gosh, yeah. People be starving. And Jorah's still there. Yay. I noticed, and this is very nitpicky and stupid, but she changed her shirt. Because the last shirt that I remember had, like, dragon scale kind of pattern. And this one didn't. And I'm like, how does she have time or, like, or another set of clothes when everyone left? Like, how could you do a clothing change? Like, this doesn't make sense.
That's interesting. I don't think I noticed that. I guess if that was the case, maybe it was just more of showing the increased desperation. Because every time we're seeing Daenerys right now, it's just like things are getting worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plus it looks like it's just really freaking hot out there.
Yeah.
So maybe she had to do the wardrobe change just to survive. But things are extremely, extremely desperate for her. I don't know if they could get any worse from where we see them there, where they're starving. They clearly don't have much water. And, you know, she's sending off some of her, you know, most closest advisors, best protectors, you know, kind of a last ditch effort.
Yeah. And then the only one that we see back from, his horse comes back and only comes back with his head. And in addition to that, they cut off his ponytail, which means I guess he lost the battle with the cow. Because I thought that was what they did. They cut off the hair when they lose.
They totally disgraced him.
Yeah. And according to their religion, if his body isn't burned, his soul is destroyed and he can't join their ancestors. So this is another look into their ideology and religion, which, you know, not every, I guess, family or camp or whatever in Westeros would consider this, like, sacrilegious.
Yeah, the Dothraki are definitely very spiritual, and they take that all of that very seriously. And you know, you hear in that scene when the handmaid is, you know, bawling her eyes out about the rider that dies, you know, she mentions that he can't make it to the Nightlands, which is what this episode is titled for. And it's kind of a very subtle little line of dialogue that is, you know, you could totally miss it based on what's going on.
I did. I totally missed it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it's funny, just on that note, like when I went back and was watching the episode and kind of knowing everything that happens, the name struck me as like a foreshadow, right? Because I think in episode one of this season, we saw the Raven come in and says that, you know, it's officially the end of summer. And so now the Long Night is coming. And so, you know, with all the stuff that's happening, things are kind of gearing up and kind of getting bleak for Westeros. But then I heard that line and I was like, oh, well, that's probably what it was named for. But I had all these thoughts in my head of what it was. It just a double meaning or whatever, but they were specifically talking about that part of the Dothraki lore.
Yeah, but I kind of agree with your double meaning, because I think the most, the example that I remember the most is the one last season where it's called the Golden Crown,
mm-hmm.
where Viserys gets his golden crown dies. So that's a, you know, double entendre right there. So no, I totally get that. Like, yeah, it's getting darker. Winter is coming and, you know, shit's getting real.
Oh yeah. So let me ask you here, just because I think it's one of these moments that's really big for Daenerys, but what is your thoughts on Daenerys so far and kind of where she's at, like her character? What do you think of her?
Let's see. I do like her. I think some of her choices have been very questionable, but I think some of it, because you see her first and she has no power, and then she gets married and learns her power and, you know, grows to become this great person, and she has a great relationship and she's pregnant and everything's coming up Daenerys.
Yep.
And then her husband gets sick, and you realize again that her power only came through a relationship, and she's truly powerless again. So I think, and then, you know, with the whole trying to bring him back, and, you know, she loses her child and essentially loses her husband, like she was just grasping at power that she couldn't hold on to. So I think now she's just going to get power the way that she, I guess, sees, you know, because I think she still thinks that the throne is rightly hers, because she's a Targaryen, she's the last dragon.
Yep. Well, she's got some lift from what happened at the end of first season, where she comes out of the fire. I mean, I think that would give everybody an ego boost, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like, I survived, and now I have these cute pet dragons. I'm the coolest.
Yep.
Now I do like her, and I like that she's coming into her own. I don't trust her as like a totally not sane, but reasonable person, I'd say.
Sure.
But I mean, she's gone through a lot, so it makes sense. But I think she's just, this is the only way that she can pick herself up. So I like her. I'm interested in her story, but I just feel like she's made so many bad decisions.
The jury's still out. I look at Daenerys and just see her as like the embodiment of willpower. You know, like if you hear a lot of the stuff she talks about, and even like, right, like as in this scene, the horse is coming up. He's got no rider. Clearly something is wrong. Jorah tries to hide her from, you know, seeing the gruesome head. And she's just like, no, I have to see it. He was blood of my blood, you know, and she doesn't shy away. She's just like, I am going to keep moving forward. I'm not going to shy away from anything. And like, that's just all I can ever think about with her, is it's just like, if you saw somebody that was nothing but willpower just moving forward, you know, that would be Daenerys.
That's very true. Yeah, she's, you know, gone to the lowest of lows and the highest of highs, and she's still continuing on, even though she's seen both. She's just trying to, and now she's making her own path because she has nobody else
right
truly tied to her. So this is her time to shine, which I am excited about. Although I don't like Jorah anymore. I liked him last season, and now I don't trust him. I think he's weird, and I'm not excited about it. But what does blood of my blood mean? I was trying to figure out that, like, logistically.
So in the Dothraki lore, and I think they kind of touch on it in season one, when she's meeting Khal Drogo, but the specific riders that like stay closest to the Khals, you know, like their bodyguards, their top fighters, they talk about how they are, you know, essentially blood of their blood, like they're brothers without being actually brothers. You know, they consider themselves to be, you know, family, even though they may have come from different backgrounds. But that's the way I've always understood it, was, you know, essentially once you swear that oath to your cow or your Khaleesi, Nick, you know, you will go anywhere with them, you're going to take care of them, they are your blood, you are their blood, we're in this together, that kind of thing.
Okay, because I wasn't sure if it was like literal, and that didn't make sense to me, because I was like, you're not related, like you were married to somebody that's related to you, but like this doesn't make sense. So okay, right. Okay, as long as it's not like, yeah, we're literally blood. No, okay, cool.
Yeah, I think it's more of that symbolism, you know, just like your tightest people, you know, the ones that you'll ride or die with no matter what.
Okay, got it. So Dothraki version of ride or die. This makes sense now. Okay, cool. So then we go to a boat, and you find out that it's going to the Iron Islands, and it's freaking Theon who convinced Rob that he should go and talk to his father. And so there's this weird castle, and those swinging bridges look so dangerous.
Right.
And there are people walking on them. And I'm like, it's got to be windy. You're on the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
There was no railing. Like, how many people have died from, like, running on that bridge?
Right. And it looks like it's, like, hundreds of feet up, you know, not just a couple stories, but it's like, built on these, like, jagged cliffs that are coming out of the ocean, and they're hooked with drawbridges. So it's definitely, I really like the look of the Iron Islands because it is unique. And I couldn't remember, but I think this is the first time they showed it in the series.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm with you. Like, it's intimidating. There's no way. I'd be like, I'll go to the first one, and I'm never passing on one of these bridges ever again.
Yep. This is my home now. Sorry.
But it's an interesting thing because you see Theon is just, like, giddy. You know, he is so excited. He thinks he's going to come back to just this fanfare. He's talking to the cabin girl, you know, as they're sailing up. and he is just like, man, there's going to be a party for me. I'm the biggest thing to come back here for these people in 10 years. And, you know, he is just full of all the confidence and arrogance of the world.
Those are exactly my notes. Like, he thinks he's going to be, he expects people to be waiting. And then he was talking about, you know, Iron Islanders and how they're hard men and we have wives for breeding, but then we need salt wives. And I was like, who the heck is this girl? Because at first I thought she was a prostitute he had brought with her. And then you find out she's talking about her father. I'm like, oh my gosh, she's just on this ship. Like, this is terrible.
Yeah,
oh,
it's her daddy's ship. And she's just riding in the back seat. But he, you know, I guess the captain gave her to Theon for whatever he needs.
I guess. And I was like, oh no, poor girl.
But it's funny because you say you think that she's a prostitute or something, like, you know, he makes that distinction that she absolutely is not because he didn't pay her. So she's supposed to be cool with her dad now just because he didn't give her any money.
Yes, like, everything's supposed to be cool. And she's like, no, you know, take me with you because my father will call me a whore. And he's like, you're not, because I didn't pay you. And I was like, no, bad decisions. What are you doing?
It's so true. And, you know, it's so weird with some of these characters, and especially because in the show they're older, you know, they definitely raise the age of the actors for the show. In the books, they're all, you know, teenagers. They're 8, 12, 14, you know. I think Rob and Theon are literally like 14, 15 or something like that in the books. So, you know, you think about the things that they're going through that lens a little bit, if you have read the books, you know, and you realize, like, what a conflicting situation all of this would be for people that young, you know, with feudal systems and honor and duty and loyalty and the classes. You know, it's like there's a lot of conflicts going on between these characters, just even in some of these interactions, right? Like, the cabin girl is like, I can't even stay with my own family anymore because of what just happened. And she was pretty much didn't even have a choice in it, right? She was probably given to Theon because he's the highborn.
Yeah, and I mean, she was kind of okay with it, but it was kind of forced as well. And she even said, my father thinks Iron Islanders are rapists. And he was like, nope, but it almost looked that way. Like, you know, whatever, she consent could be questioned there.
Very true.
And that's interesting about the age in the written book versus what they show here. My sister always likes to say when I get angry at one of their choices, and she's like, they're just shitty teenagers. Like, they're making dumb choices because that's what they do. That's what you and I did when we were shitty teenagers. And I was like, thanks.
Oh, yeah. Very little life experience.
Yeah, so putting that much pressure on them or anything like that is just, I can't imagine. And so putting yourself in that situation at that age, yeah, it would be horrible. Let's see. So then we go back to King's Landing, and we're at Littlefinger's brothel, where he's just creepily spying on people because that's what you do when you own a brothel.
Apparently.
Yes, and then some old guy is mad because the woman that he was with is crying, so he gets another one, and then you find out that it's Roz, and he's like, yep. What's up? You know, did he hit you? And at first he seems, like, concerned about her, and then she says that she's so upset because they came in and killed her friend's baby because he was one of the Baratheon bastards, and she can't stop thinking about it.
Completely understandable.
Yes, and, like, I don't know how much time has passed since then, but it can't have been that much later. And yeah, even if it's not yours, you're going to think about it and you're going to get upset. And maybe it interrupts your job of being a prostitute.
Yeah, and you see here the dual nature of Littlefinger, right? Like, at times, you go back and forth with him because at times you think, you know, he might be one of the more normal characters in the entire show. But then you see stuff like what he did here and you realize that he is ruthless to the teeth. You know, he cares about nothing other than his own success. You're pretty much telling Roz, sorry that happened, but get over it. Make me happy. Make me money. And there's some intense scene right here.
Yeah, it really escalated. And I try and listen to, like, you know, if the music changes or something. And so he was first telling a story and it was okay. And we were going somewhere. And then the tone changed. And I was like, oh, no, this is not going to end well for Roz.
Yep.
And so, yeah, he tells the story of a woman that was sad that he sold to a wealthy man who did whatever he wanted. And he got all his money back. And that's the moral of the story, is make me money.
Yep. His losses were mitigated.
Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, but you get the night off. But then tomorrow you're going to be happy.
Yeah. And you think about such a turn, right? Because as he's telling the story, like you're talking about, he's like consoling Roz. You know, he's like giving her a hug. And, you know, you're mm-hmm. like, man, this is a good boss. And then it just kind of goes the complete opposite.
Yeah, like the worst boss. Yeah, like no feelings whatsoever, even though he seemed to truly care about his employees. And they say, oh, you know, you're the most expensive. And you've seen him and her have a relationship, like,
right,
she's moving up the ranks,
right?
So you thought that they would have a better one, but he's just like, you know, shit happens, and yeah, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, at the end of, I think, episode one of this season, Rose is kind of at a high point, right? You know, she's left Molestown, she's come down to King's Landing, she went from, you know, small town country girl to now essentially what looks like the assistant manager mm-hmm. of this brothel. Yep. You know, she's training other girls and everything, and then boom, you know, now she absolutely knows that she's in a very dangerous place, and that Littlefinger's much more dangerous than maybe she ever thought.
Oh yeah, yeah, he definitely hit it before, but yeah, his true nature, like we said, is coming out of all the characters in this season. So we'll hopefully she'll make it the next day, but we don't go back to her. So then we go to Tyrion, and he's with the leader of the Gold Cloaks, and they're like talking, drinking wine, and Tyrion asks about what happened at Littlefinger's brothel. Like, oh, by the way, I heard there was some ruckus, and like, what's happening?
He drops that bomb on Slint real quick after the feast.
Oh, so great. Yeah, he's like, oh, peace depended on killing babies. And he's like, well, orders, you know.
You just do whatever, you know.
Yeah, this was awesome. I really like Tyrion. Yeah, and then he goes into, they said it much better than I will repeat it, but he asked about giving the orders to murder Ned Stark's men, and he said, yes, and I would do it again. And then, yeah, he's like, oh, but you know, you were already bought, so obviously you did that.
Jenna Slint tries to act so hard and, you know, honorable and the whole nine yards. He's trying to play at this life of hanging out with all these royals, but he's just a world-class piece of shit and has no honor, you know, changes loyalty on a dime. Just like you said, you know, he was supposed to help out Ned in season one, but then, you know, you find out that Littlefinger had already paid him, so he's pretty much just only caring about the money.
Yeah, and he keeps saying, I have friends that are high up. Like, I have, you know, I have companions and people will help me. And Tyrion's like, you really think they're your friends and they're going to help you? See what happens.
Right.
Because I'm getting rid of you and nobody's going to help you.
Yeah, I thought this scene was kind of a good one for Tyrion coming into his own as Hand of the King, right? Especially after what we talked about earlier with Varys and kind of that threat that happened there. Tyrion realizes that he's got to put people around him that he can trust. Otherwise, he'll probably end up like the previous Hands of the King. but he seems to be only one of the royals that really has enough sense to look at things like that. You know, there he considers how the lowly people view the ruling class and how that could impact things. So I appreciated what he did here too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I like how he keeps using the example of what happened to the last hand. He keeps bringing up Ned and he keeps bringing up what happened. And he's like, you know, I don't really feel safe with you around me. But guess who I do feel safe with? This guy that basically saved my life. Yep. He's in charge now. So that's what happens. And I was so excited. Bronn got a promotion and it was the best thing that happened.
Yeah, Bronn's just moving on up in the world. I think this was his second big promotion, you know, essentially first one being hooking up with Tyrion. And now he's leading the Gold Cloaks, you know, and just a couple months ago, he was a nobody kind of mercenary. But I don't know if you caught it at the very end, but it kind of cracked me up, right? Because Tyrion has all the back and forth with Slint about kind of just like selling himself out for money. And then Tyrion was asking Bronn, you know, if he would ever do the same thing. And Bronn's response is, yeah, it just depends on how much, you know, how much they pay me.
Yeah, I was like, oh, no. Yeah, like, oh.
Can you trust him?
Makes me a little concerned. Yeah, I don't know. They seem pretty tight, but we'll see. I think Tyrion's done pretty well with him so far. And Bronn's kind of proved his loyalty to a certain extent. So we'll see where it goes from there. But I am excited about those two coming into their own and moving up and like Tyrion actually making decisions as the Hand of the King, because that's what he is.
And you know, I mean, sending Slint to the wall was just Tyrion doing his duty and filling the needs of his other people. So, you know, Mormont asked for men, boom, now you got Janos Slint.
And he's doing what his father asked, which is also to look for people who could be traitors. And he's like, well, this guy was a traitor to the last hand, so he could be a traitor to me / my father, so let's get rid of him.
That's very true too. Yep, that's very true.
Yeah. So then we go back to the Castle Black not yet in service camp. And we've got Gendry running around or walking around. And then we've got those two dumb kids, which I did not know they were coming with the camp. I just thought, it took me like 2 minutes to realize that was his name. And I said, the fat kid is named Hot Pie. I have like 5 question marks behind that. Like, this is a name? Like, what is, oh my God. So yeah, thought they were randos. Apparently they're characters now, but they are afraid of Gendry. And they're talking about armor and knights and everything, and Gendry's like, it doesn't mean you're a knight if you have armor, anyone can buy it. And they're like, how do you know? And he's like, because I sold it.
Yeah, right.
Like, come on.
I've beaten out more than a few breastplates in my day. It was kind of funny scene, because you don't really see too many scenes in Game of Thrones where the kids can just be kids, you know? And so I kind of looked at this scene as that with Hot Pie and them, like, they have no idea what they're into. You know, they don't have any life experience. Hot Pie's just trying to look real cool around the other guys. You know, Gendry's the popular kid, but yeah, they just call him out on all his bullshit though, which is what they're like, you don't know anything about knights and armor. You know, how'd you know he was a knight? Cause he was wearing armor. Well, what makes you a knight? Well, people that wear armor. Ah, shut up,
Hot Pie. In circles. Yeah, I've been to a battle. No, you haven't. Yeah, two men fought outside of a tavern.
Like, no, sorry, that doesn't count. Yeah, two of the kids talking shit to the other one. Yeah, very simple discussion that has nothing to do with anything, but it's true. And Hot and the other kid, they don't know who they're talking to. Basically, you know, Arya Stark and one of Robert Baratheon's sons. They're just like, well, I'm doing my thing.
Yeah, if they only knew the company they were in, I think that they would be acting a little different. But kind of speaking on that, you know, we do see a big reveal come up right after this.
Let's see. So Arya was asking Gendry about why he's being basically stalked by the Gold Cloaks. And he says, don't ask any questions because it's bad luck. Because the last two hands asked about it. And you saw how that went. And then, yeah, Gendry brings up, I can't remember how he said it, but he was like, well, clearly you're a girl. And she's like, no. He's like, all right, well, then pull out your penis.
Yeah.
And she's like, no. But then she goes on, and I was surprised, blurts out who she is and where she's going and who helped her and everything. And he seems actually surprised. But then he's like, oh, well, you're a lady and I should be bowing and all this shit. Like, this was the best part of this episode because I actually laughed out loud. And I never, like, this show is never funny. So this was, like, the best part. Because, like, yeah, it's just essentially these two kids being kids and being stupid. And Arya gets pissy and she, like, pushes him away. And he's like, whatever, this is fine.
Yeah, it's so funny because Gendry immediately kind of goes into that commoner versus lady lord role, right? And And then Arya, you know, going back to early in season one, they established that she has no interest in being a lady, or, you know, she doesn't seem to care about being kind of like a highborn or whatever you would call it. I really thought that this was a good moment to help solidify their friendship, right? Now they both know that they've got some dirt on each other. They're going to kind of look out for each other as they move through. So, but Gendry, not as dumb as maybe he looked, you know. Obviously, he was smart enough to figure out Arya's secret without being told. So there's more to him than maybe we're seeing so far.
Oh, yeah, definitely observant and smart. And the only thing he was surprised about was that she was a Stark. And I couldn't tell if he was serious at first when he was saying, oh my gosh, you're a lady.
And he's like, I've peed in front of you. Like, why was this okay? Like, I can't believe this happened. And then she's just like, nope, I'm a tough person that, you know, doesn't want to be a royal or whatever. So yeah, I really like, and I didn't expect their friendship at first. So I'm excited that, yeah, they're kind of on the same team. They're, yeah, it's solidified because they have each other's backs and secrets. Let's see. And then we're at the Iron Island port now. We've gone into port. And Theon's approaching, and guess what? Nobody's fucking there for him.
Nobody shows up.
Nope. There's no parade. The old guy that he talks to is not impressed. He has to pay him with gold, right, for him to do anything. Poor entitled Theon.
Yeah, I love how he's just like, hey, you know, Prince Theon here. Like, anybody should even recognize him after 10 years of going from, you know, whatever, a couple years old to a teenager. Like, nobody would have a clue who you are, bro.
No, yeah. It's like, how would they know what you look like? And then even when he says, like, it's me, the guy's like, and? Can I have
right,
it?
And?
So he says he's trying to get to Pyke, which is that the castle, Pyke?
Yeah, I think the Iron Islands, I think, is the name for the whole area. And then Pyke is right where the actual castle we were talking about a little bit ago with the drawbridges and everything. I believe that is the specific part of the Iron Islands.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so he wants to get there. And then some woman comes up and she's like, I'll take you. And he immediately starts hitting on her. And I was like,
trash. Did you see how he looks her up and down, like, as soon as they put the camera on him?
Yes, I was so mad. I was like, I cannot believe you. Like, just the first woman that you see, you're just like, yep, this one. Even though you just had sex in the boat. And you don't know this woman from anything, but the fact that she knew who he was, I was like, oh my God, he probably has a huge boner now because he knows she knows who he is.
Well, he even makes a comment about the Ironborn, you know, being hard dudes. And it's just like, oh my God, it's just the worst positioning for that piece of dialogue.
I know.
Like, you're such an arrogant little kid.
I know. Yeah. And I was honestly standing up for him last season because I was like, he's just emotionally stunted and he needs to grow. But this episode, I'm like, he is trash. Like, I'm over it. I'm done. I'm sorry.
Well, he's clearly proud of what he's been doing. And especially with the war fighting and everything, he thinks he's got this position. You know, you pick up on it here and there. The Ironborn are just a little different when it comes to everything, mm-hmm, and how they view the world. So it's a clash of cultures for sure.
Yeah, and he's kind of stuck in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because then he goes, she takes him to Pyke, still hitting on her. And I was like, because at first she was kind of like not into it, and then she seems like super into it. And I was like, what? I don't understand these
she
two people.
On.
Yeah. And then he goes in to see his father, and there is this dope fireplace with a squid carved into it. Did you notice that?
Right?
That was so cool.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because I put a note here, and the set design in all of Game of Thrones is awesome, but this was one of my favorites because the Kraken over the fireplace, I'm like, I need that in my house.
Right? Oh my God. I was like, if nothing else, yes, I have to have this fireplace. And I was like, this is the coolest thing I've seen in this show. So neat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
They have one of the best sigils out of all the houses, you know, the black and the gold, and then the Kraken.
Wait, it is the Kraken? Theirs is the Kraken? Yeah. That's so cool! Yep.
The Greyjoys are the Kraken, because they're all about the sea and everything like that, so that's their thing.
All right, well, that's who I'm joining now. If nothing else, because of the sigil, this is amazing. I had no idea it was the Kraken. Okay, I'm so distracted now and excited. So then you see his father, Balon, for the first time. And he seems pretty mean Because he talks shit to his son as soon as he gets in there. And he says he's dressed like a woman.
Yeah, right.
And and that the Starks have made you theirs.
Yep. Yeah, he comes off cold. His eyes, when he first finally turns around to Theon, you know, you can just see the ice in them. And you know, for whatever reason, he is not happy. Obviously, he was probably always pissed at Ned Stark for taking his kid, but he did not have any love for what they sent back. And poor Theon is just, you know, looking to come in and make his dad proud, right? Like, hey, I'm still alive, yeah. A. And then B, I'm doing pretty well for myself, you know? And Balin is just not having it.
Yeah, basically, if you're not like a warrior and like his version of a man's man, then like, you're not my son.
Yep.
Like, have you forgotten your own blood is something that he says. He was like, well, Rob sees me as his brother. And he's like, don't you dare say that. He is not your brother.
Well, because Theon had an actual brother that was killed. So I think there's probably some resentment there. But the other thing, too, is kind of like we were talking about with the Dothraki and how they are people that have some serious culture and beliefs and all of that. You know, the Ironborn, Balin brings it up with Theon when he's talking about his clothes. He asks him, you know, did you pay the iron price or the gold price? Because the Greyjoys, their house words are we do not sow. So their whole thing is that we don't plant seeds. We don't cultivate, you know, businesses. We rape, pillage, and steal shit, and you can't even show things off or wear things unless you pulled them from somebody you killed. So it's a pretty intense culture that they roll with on the Iron Islands.
Yeah, and you don't even get like the half of that at first. I'm sure you'll see it more, but yeah, it's just like go to the beat of their own drum, and yeah, they just take everything. They take everything that they earn, basically, and so nothing's just given or bought with gold. Yeah, so it's very disdainful.
Yep.
And then the plot twist of the episode is that, because Balin's like, well, who's going to like lead the ships or whatever? And Theon's like, well, I'm going to. And he's like, no. And then the woman walks in and it's his fucking sister. And I was like, first of all, ew. Second of all, why is she like this? And why is this happening?
Yeah, it definitely is a big reveal, and we kind of glossed over it when the scene started, but Theon got a little handsy with her when they were riding up the horse, and
yeah,
it might not be as bad as a Jaime Cersei situation, but, you know, it's more than brothers and sisters should be doing.
Right, and she let it happen. I guess, yeah, it's a funny joke, and maybe they have a weird sense of humor, but that's not cool.
No, I mean, you can tell that she is just messing with him to the max. And,
yeah,
you know, even when she walked in, I think he turns around because it still hadn't dawned on him. And he's like, I told you to stay outside. You know, who are you to be barging in here?
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes and cuddles up to daddy.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, my God, wait, you're my sister, which I guess he wouldn't assume that that was his sister because she didn't say, because how would he know what she still looks like?
Right, when... right.
But it's just so weird. But yeah, no, she's taken over basically since Theon was gone and their other brother has died. And so he said, oh, she's earned everything and she's going to lead the attack. And Theon's mad because no woman can lead an attack because he's a misogynist.
Well, they all are in this land and time.
Maybe I guess Yara is the exception for Balin or Balon.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I think normally, if the older brothers would have been there, Yara would never ascended to where she's at. But if you think about the fact that Theon's older brother was killed back when the rebellion happened and then Theon was taken, Balin Greyjoy didn't have anybody other than Yara to take over.
Yeah, so it's just kind of by situation, she kind of lucked in and it was the best situation for her.
Yep.
Yeah, so it sounds like now that Balin he wants to take his crown by iron, and then Theon's like, well, you don't have enough people to go against the Lannisters, and he's like, we're not going against the Lannisters, and so my notes are like, the Stark then? I guess that's who they'd be going against?
Yeah, definitely have to see what happens, because he clearly turns down the offer to join Rob, but then they pretty much just kind of close the door on the scene as soon as he says, you know, who said anything about the Lannisters, and so we have no idea what the Greyjoys are going to be doing from here, but Theon's got to figure out what the hell he's going to be doing.
Yeah, because now he's there, so he doesn't essentially have to come back, I guess, if he doesn't want to. So now it's between family and his not family, and yeah, he's just kind of stuck And I don't know if he's gonna betray Rob or if he's gonna betray his family. So yeah, I'm interested to see where that goes. And then it's another person basically throwing their hat into the ring for some sort of crown or kingdom.
That is true. I think earlier in the episode, Cersei said something about 4 or 5 kings because they get the word about the king beyond the wall. But yeah, the Greyjoys have always considered themselves kings of the Iron Island. So it is essentially another one added to the mix.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but then we're not sure what kingdom they're trying to get to now.
Exactly.
Let's see. So then we go to what I think is called Dragon Island?
Dragonstone.
Dragonstone. Okay. I was trying to read it in the beginning music thing where it goes to all the different places and shows you where you're going. And I was like, it says dragon something.
Okay. So we go to the Dragonstone.
It is an island though. So you were close.
So then we see Davos and his son talking to a guy that's a pirate.
Salador San, that's his name. The pirate shows up.
I like his name. And so basically Davos is trying to get Salador to smuggle them into or give them ships to get to King's Landing. Is that right?
Well, I think he's trying to just get Salador to join Stannis' side. So Davos and Salador have a long history. You know, they're both pirates and they've worked together, you know, for 20 or 30 years or whatever he says. But now Stannis is mixing it with Thanos. He would have won all the wars if he had Thanos. But Stannis is very desperate for men right now. So he's got all his people, you know, looking for any support that they can get. And the ships, I think, are the big thing because he mentions they need to sail into King's Landing if they were going to do their attack or whatever that Stannis wants to do. And so he really needs the ships that the pirates have.
Yeah, exactly. Because like you just said, they're on an island. And if they want to become the king, they have to get over to where the other king is. Yeah, and they keep emphasizing that he doesn't have a big army, but he knows how to lead. And in his case, he says that he's the true rightful, you know, heir and claim to the throne. Because none of the Baratheon children are truly Baratheon. And so he's like, well, this is my destiny, basically. I can't remember who said it, but Stannis is the one true king, I think. It was the younger guy, the son, who said that, because Salador is like, okay, you know, I'll do all this stuff for gold or whatever, but I want to have sex with the queen.
And I was like, what? Where did that come from?
It's such a pirate thing to say, right? You know, he's like, I need the gold, elect the power, whatever, but if I do this, I'm gonna fuck the queen.
Yeah.
And the son's just like, what? You don't get to just rape queens here. And he's like, what do you say? He's like, I didn't say I was going to rape her. I said I was going to fuck her.
Yeah. And then he was like, I'm very persuasive. And he's like, well, you haven't. And then he's like, well, I've never tried to have sex with you. And the kid's like, oh no, like get away from me. Like, this is not good.
Completely creeped out.
Oh yeah. I felt bad for him at that point. So it seems decided pirate's going to go with Stannis. And then the father and son have like a little back and forth. And the son seems to be like really religious.
Mm-hmm. He's totally sold.
Is he religious towards like the light and towards Stannis? Or is there some other higher power that he's thinking about? Or I guess that's two different things.
I don't know. Oh, I mean, he talked in the conversation with Davos. He talks about how when Davos was out at sea, when he was young, that he would always light a candle and pray. And then now he's pretty much praying to the Lord of Light. So I think it's always been part of his character, even though we didn't see that back then, just from that line. But kind of on those things, I love the challenges that the kid got throughout all of this, you know, but from Davos and from Salador San, because I don't know if you remember, but on these same lines, when he talks about the one true king and the one true God, Salador says something to the effect of, you know, bullshit, I've been all over the world, everyone thinks their God's the one true God, you know?
Yes.
He's just like over it.
Yeah, no, and you're right, and that's such a good point. Yeah, it's true of every land, every story, every place. Like, yeah, everyone thinks that their God is the right one. And so, yeah, I love that he actually said that to this young kid who's like, nope, I'm right and I believe what I believe. And he's like,
right,
you can, that's fine, but it doesn't mean it's right.
Exactly. Yeah. And then Davos kind of locks it in when he comes back. And I think he said something along like, well, whatever, Stannis is my god, you know?
Mm-hmm. And he says he doesn't have a god. And he's like, well, yeah, then I'll just say Stannis is, because you want an answer.
Yep. I thought all in all that, you know, this was another scene where the dialogue really shines for George R. R. Martin. Because a lot of the show here at the beginning, the first couple of seasons, is pulled almost word for word out of the book. And so, you know, he's just got these gems of social commentary and things like that that are built in. They're not so on the nose. And I can't get enough of these kinds of scenes, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Definitely this is
the wittiness.
Yes. Like the verbal, like, sparring and back and forth and everything is really good. And to know that it does actually come from the author is impressive, because I've not been the biggest fan of his writing, especially towards, so far, female characters. I don't know if it becomes different, but like, I really was shitting on him the first couple episodes, but his writing is actually quite good as far as dialogue.
See, that's really interesting that you say that. We're talking about this episode, so I won't spoil anything, but I will just say that I often say to people that if you watch or read Game of Thrones and don't realize that the women are the most important and most powerful characters in it, then you're missing something.
Okay.
So I'll just leave that with you. It might be just my opinion, but I think that actually they may start weak, but I think that the women actually shine more than almost anything in the show.
So, yeah, I think definitely there's been a turn in this season and people are coming to their own. And I think it's been explained to me, and I've noticed that, you know, in the first couple episodes, it's just hard to get everyone like out there and explained, and so there's so much like legwork that they have to do, and they have to lay the groundwork for the world and the people. So I just feel like it was unbalanced before, men versus women, who we were focused on, but I think now it's become more so. Yeah, definitely not as mad as I was when I started this.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I mean, and it really, you think about most anything you see from like feudal times or fantasy, the class differences between men and women are usually always part of that, just because of the history in the real world, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's where we were at, you know, hundreds of years ago. And so I do think that it's fair to say, because they do kind of crap on the women early on in the show, but I think that it transforms over time. So I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to break your rules and spoil anything, but when you brought that up, I thought it was interesting.
No, yeah. And that's nice to hear a different perspective. And so I'll be looking for that now to see where we go with the women of Westeros. Let's see. So then we're back to King's Landing, and Cersei found out that Tyrion fired the head of the Gold Cloaks, and basically it's a little match of Queen Regent versus Hand of the King, which neither one of them is actually the king, but they both have power.
Right. You see a good little chunk of the sibling rivalry here. You know, Cersei and Tyrion are always kind of going at it. I thought it was interesting, once again, how Tyrion is so focused on the support of the common people.
Yeah.
And how they view the Lannisters and the Baratheons and all them. And, you know, Cersei pretty much just laughs it off and doesn't give a shit. You know, she's like, whatever. But Tyrion knows that, you know, there's millions of common folk, and if they wanted to, they could storm the castle and take them all out. But Cersei, I don't think, believes that anybody below her can possibly hurt her.
Exactly, which I feel like she's kind of lost sight of things, because in the first season, when she was talking to Joffrey about ruling and what to do, and he's like, well, I'm going to tell these people to do this. And she's like, why would they listen to you? And he said, because I'm the king and I tell them to. But now she's making the same, you know, comments, like, it doesn't matter what the people think. And
yep.
And then, yeah, Tyrion says it's hard to rule over people that want you dead. And she's like, whatever, it doesn't matter. So I think she's just kind of spiraling. Yeah. And she sees that she's losing power, because the next thing that Tyrion asks is about the order to kill all the children. And then he kind of weasels it out that Joffrey gave the order specifically, and you're not sure if he told her or not. Yep. But either way, it's not good if she didn't stop it, and if she didn't know, like, that's where she's seeing her loss of power.
For sure. Yeah, she can tell that Joffrey is getting a little bit out of, you know, even her control as the mom. But I was curious what your thoughts were when they revealed that it was Joffrey's order, not Cersei. Did you have theories on who had given that order before this scene happened?
Yes, I honestly thought it was Joffrey because, and it just felt that way at the end of the first episode of this season, because right before they did that, there was a scene between Joffrey and Cersei, and he says, you know, he talks about the rumors that he's been hearing about his uncle slash father.
That's right.
And then he says, oh, you know, well, maybe that's not true, but I heard that, you know, my father slept with other women. And like, so I think he's so paranoid and like driven with power that, yes, if he saw any other random children as a threat, he would be the one to order them to be killed. I don't know how he would have found out. I mean, it was obvious, like Ned did the legwork and figured it out. And I don't know how he figured out which children they were. But right. I was not surprised to find out that it was actually him. And I was more surprised when they were saying, oh, was it Cersei or was it Joffrey?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to know if, you know, Joffrey had help in doing this. Because like you said, like, how would he have known all these things? But at the same time, when you're the king, you could pretty much go ask anything of anybody. And, you know, if they're smart, they're going to figure it out for you and tell you.
Yes.
Yeah, we really see kind of a real step in these first two episodes of the season as far as Joffrey's entire character changing and what he's capable of.
Oh, yeah, just unspeakable amounts of horribleness. And then, let's see, Tyrion, and I don't know why he does this, because read the room, but he jokes about the incest rumors, and I was like, oh no, but he jokes about it, but they both kind of look seriously at each other, like they're not laughing about it.
Oh, because she knows he knows.
I mean, yeah, they both know, but I'm like, oh, why would you even, like, gross, but,
yeah.
And then Cersei was, of course, mean, and then it was like, you know what the biggest joke is that you basically killed our mother in childbirth. And I was like, that doesn't make sense. Like, that's, I don't know. I didn't think that was a good insult. It was mean, but it wasn't clever.
No, it wasn't clever, but I don't think that's necessarily Cersei's way. She's more about just taking the knife and gutting people, you know? So like when she makes statements like that, it tends to be whatever she thinks can cut that person at, you know, as hard as possible. And, you know, poor Tyrion, because, you know, his whole life he's just been getting crapped on from her for the fact that the mom died when he was born.
So that was sad, because he was like on such a high of like, you know, trying to figure things out and kind of basically push her buttons. And it's like, well, that's what you get for pushing her buttons. She was mean to you. Typical sibling rivalry, right?
Yep.
I don't know. We'll see what happens between them. It's just, it's all awkward. And I'm just waiting for it to like explode with the Lannisters, because everyone is talking about these rumors and it's spreading. I mean, people have to find out at some point, but like, how will it be confirmed? And like,
right.
What's actually going to happen? Like,
I don't know. I'm just, yeah, I'm waiting for that bomb to drop. Like, actually, because, you know, it's just been swirling around.
Yeah, because right now it's kind of like on the cover of Westerosi TMZ. You know, it's just... it's just some rumor that was put out there by Stannis, you know?
Yeah, and so, but he did the right thing, and he sent letters to everyone so that, like, the whole world is talking about it. Yeah, oh man, that was just, like, the smartest thing that he's done.
Yep, it's out there now.
Gosh.
Let's see, and then we go back to the Dragonstone Island, and you see the father and son again, and they're like, I guess they're kind of making like a war plan, because they've got like wooden ships and like a fake whatever land, and, you know, playing at war or whatever.
Did you notice what the table was?
It looked like the sea. No, I didn't really get any real details. What was it?
It's one of my favorite set pieces of the entire show, but it's a completely carved table. It's a map of Westeros.
Oh.
And you might get some additional views of it in future episodes and stuff. That was kind of quick in here, but it's actually the full map of Westeros carved into a table. I think they actually did build it and then sold it after the show ended, but I always thought that was a really cool piece of set design there. because they are war planning, like you said, with the ships and the different armies and things like that.
But I didn't think that they had actually carved everything out very specific. I thought it was more general. So that's insane. But it's like the actual land. So it's basically like a map on a table that they can plan everything around. So that's crazy. And then, Stannis walks in with Melisandre, the damn witch, and they want to know how it went with Salador, and they're like, oh yeah, it'll be fine. Stannis is like, well, do you trust him? And Davos is like, no, but when he wants to get gold, he gets it, so we're all good.
Right, yeah, you can see that desperation, you know, even though Stannis might be happy that he got more men, like, he knows still that things are desperate.
Yeah, it's not going well, and he gets frustrated, so he sends father and son away, but not before Melisandre whispers to Mathys, death by fire is the purest death. And Stannis is like, why did you say that?
That's kind of morbid.
It was, and I didn't really, was she threatening him? And I don't understand why.
I don't know if it took it as a threat so much as, you can tell he's one of the impressionable minds, and like we were saying earlier, you know, he's been pretty devout to the religion. And I kind of took it just more so as Melisandre continuing to plug, you know, the Lord of Light and anything she can in these people that keep them, you know, coming back to her, thinking that they're on the right path, whatever it may be. You know, I just kind of took it more like a controlling type thing.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was like menacing or if she was like actually trying to engage with him. So okay, that makes more sense, because she's basically their religious figure right now, and if he's following whatever religion they are, then yeah, she'd be a figure that he would be interested in.
Right.
Yeah, so Stannis, like you said, is concerned. He doesn't have faith in her fake religion, and
no. He's more about reality.
Yeah, he's like, I did the thing. I followed all your stupid rules.
I said the words.
I said my words. I pulled the sword out, like, let's move on. And she's like, no, you have to like truly believe in everything. And he's like, I don't know.
Stannis is definitely the embodiment of internal conflict, because he is known throughout Westeros as being one of the most, you know, honorable, like, straight shooting, serious people that there are. And so, you know, if you think about people like that in the real world, they tend to maybe be less attracted to things like religion or stuff that maybe can't be explained. And so you can just see this back and forth between him thinking he's doing his duty and meeting what is needed for this religion. Like, you know, I said the words and it should be good, right? You know, like,
yeah.
And then what would actually be coming from her, or what it would actually take, I guess, to truly believe.
Right, and Melisandre takes an odd approach to trying to get him to believe by basically saying, you have to have sex with me, to get the Lord of Light on your side or whatever. And Stannis is like, no, I'm married, which, shocker, like, who knew that he was married? And because I mean, I even thought there was something, like, why else would he be following this crazy woman if they weren't in a relationship? But no, he has a wife, but she's like, well, you're not attracted to your wife, and she's sick, and she hasn't given you any children. So as soon as she says, I can give you a son, he's like, oh yeah, it's on. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's amazing how fast you see him kind of give up all of the way he's been, you know, with the duty and the honor and everything, and he pretty much just completely lets it all go for physical temptation, power temptation, and, you know, possible legacy when she says she can give him a son. You kind of see him go from everything he always did, which was always like, you know, stand up guy as much as possible, to maybe it's Stannis's time, maybe I should get some of mine, you know.
Yeah, it definitely tips the scales when she says that, you know, yeah, your legacy, because if he's going to become the king, then I guess he's trying to protect that legacy even more. And so he needs a son to continue on the line. And there are no other Baratheon children. So because Renly doesn't have any, and the ones that pseudo are, he knows that they're not. So, I mean, it's an odd way to manipulate, but she said the right things, and they did the deed, and so we'll see how that goes now.
Yeah, I didn't realize this, I think the first couple of times I saw it, you know, like I said, you get different perspective when you go back and watch something like this where you're just a one shot, one episode. But when he does give in to Melisandre and they do have sex, you know, it's on the table of Westeros. It's mm-hmm. essentially on the battlefield. And I kind of thought that was fitting piece of, what's the word I'm looking for?
His internal battle, maybe?
Yeah, like I thought it was just a fitting situation for his internal battle. That's where I was going with it. I was looking for a word for, you know, how they displayed it with them being on the table. But, you know, I think that he's got a lot of that internal conflict between, you know, what he's always done and what he thinks is his duty and what's right versus what she's selling him. And so I don't know, I kind of just took it when I was watching this scene as, oh man, like, you know, he's having this, his battle is mostly in his mind and now he's giving it into her on the battlefield, essentially, of Westeros. So it might have been a little cheesy, but it's just the way I took it this time around with the way that they set that scene up.
No, they definitely focused on the table and when all the pieces were falling off. So, you've kind of explained it now because I wasn't really sure, like, why they were so focused on the table and, like, the imagery, the shots from above, the imagery. Shots of their feet.
That's the word I was looking for.
Got it. So, yeah, so that makes sense that he's lost the battle in his mind and is trying to win the overall battle, which is the war. So it's
exactly.
just...
exactly.
Yeah, I knew there would be symbolism in there, but I didn't know what, so you've helped me find that. Let's see. Oh, so then we go to our last scene, which is we're at the Night Watch camp that's past the wall. And so
back at Craster's.
Yes, back at Craster's. John sees someone taking a baby somewhere, which it was who was taking the baby?
It was Craster.
It was
himself.
Craster. Okay. Yep.
It's real dark. It's kind of a hard to see scene.
Yeah, you just see it's like kind of an older guy, which I guess that would be the only one there because he only has son or he only has daughters. So John follows him, not very quietly. I thought, because like you could hear his footsteps. So I was like, right. did he not hear you coming? And then he like has his giant sword out. So it's like you're very not inconspicuous.
Yeah, there's no way you're going anywhere quiet when you're wearing all that armor.
Yeah.
And everything.
So apparently he sneaks behind the guy. And then Craster comes back. So then John hides and you hear the baby's crying and John's like trying to find it and get to it. And there's like weird noises. And then what it looked like, and it was very dark, is that one of the white zombies picked up the baby and took it away.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to see, but kind of the confirmation you get briefly is you see the really bright
the
blue
eyes.
Yes.
Okay. I did. Yeah. Okay. I thought I was imagining things, but I was like, I think I saw those.
Yeah. No, it was super quick. And it's just kind of like the thing looks around or maybe back in John's, you know, direction or something. But then he takes the baby and he walks off.
Mm-hmm. So then John like turns around because he hears something. And then, of course, it's Craster and he knocks him out. And my last note is, God damn it, John. Like, you started off so well in this episode. You knew what you were supposed to do. Like, you did the right thing. You said no. And then, of course, you have to like flip it on its head and like get in trouble with the one guy that said he would like what tear your eyes out if you like looked at his daughter wives.
Right.
Ugh.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, your first reaction is, no, John, what are you doing? But, you know, you realize, like, I mean, there's a baby on the line, so I don't see how you could look at it as any way other than,
yeah,
like, that was the right move. Like, you got to go do what you can do to protect this baby. You know, the stakes are so high when all these different characters, kind of throughout the whole two episodes here, you know, they're all willing to sacrifice innocent babies over different things, you know, their own interests. But... yeah, you know, you see John kind of put it all on the line and he doesn't even really know what he was running into.
Yeah, and I think even some of it was curiosity because he's the one that kept asking, like, what happens to the boys? Like, where are they going? What is happening? And so, yeah, part of it is, yes, if you hear a baby crying and, like, you know, want to help it, but also, like, what's going on? What's happening in this weird little, like, world that this guy has of all his being surrounded by women? So
it's a different world than Winterfell was for John.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, and that's where we end the episode.
It's a hell of a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Oh,
They just kind of take the lights out as soon as he gets hit. And, you know, you're definitely sitting there wondering, like, will he have no eyes when I start the next episode?
I don't know. Will he be chained up somewhere? Yeah. Will Sam save him? I don't know. Oh, yeah. But it's definitely not going to be good for him whatever happens next.
I think that with this episode and with John in general, you kind of see a lot of those moral decisions, you know, going up against orders and doing what's right. So,
yeah. And he's still struggling with that. And I think he's trying to find his place within the Night's Watch and with himself, because this is his first time away from home. And so he's figuring it out.
Yep, exactly.
Well, since we've gotten to the end, how do you feel about this episode now, watching it as a one shot, basically?
I was actually pretty pumped about it. You know, for me, I was thinking back to when the show debuted and kind of the different conversations I would have. I remember it might have not have been this episode specifically, but episodes like this one, you know, a little bit on the slower side, they tend to be easily overlooked by the bigger events that happen in the Game of Thrones series. And I just remember so many people at the time, just like, especially if they weren't digging Game of Thrones a ton, they would label these as, you know, too slow and boring.
Oh.
And things along those lines. But for me, these slower episodes, as much as I love good action and all of that, good special effects, like, I always really liked the slower episodes for some of the things we talked about, you know, that really high level dialogue and the plot thickening, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. So I really enjoyed going back and rewatching it. I appreciated having the reason to do so, you know, in order to come on the show here.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's interesting that you pointed out. I never realized until after I've talked about it what would technically be a slow episode or an intense episode.
But yeah, there was more talking. That sometimes just means that more is actually happening, because more is being discussed and talked about and decided. So yeah, I like these ones as well. Sometimes the action can be too chaotic.
Yeah, for sure. And especially in those older, you know, like, you think like Lord of the Rings and fantasy feudal type shows, you know, the action tends to be really chaotic and really dirty. And, you know, in an episode like this, you get to see lots of characters, which is also the other plus, is you get to actually go and make sure that you're touching on and getting updates with all of the people you might be interested in, versus, you know, if it's just a battle or something, it might be focused on a handful of them because they need that time to do that entire battle in one episode or something like that.
Oh yeah, definitely. We've hit almost all the major players in this one, which I was impressed, because normally they focus on maybe some, but yeah, we did a lot.
Yeah, we went north to south, east to west. I think this episode took us all over the map here.
So I think we've talked about the whole episode. Do you want to talk about your podcast and what you're doing?
Sure, yeah. So me and one of my lifelong friends, Kyle Eckard, we grew up together in Maryland. We've known each other since we were, you know, 4 or 5. We recently decided to embark on the podcasting journey over the last couple of months. So we started what we call Geek Ketchup, and ketchup's a play of words. It's spelled like food ketchup, you know, Heinz 57. But we're really just two lifelong, you know, nerds that have always been into video games and comics and professional wrestling and kind of anything in between with pop culture, and decided, hey, we've got this love. We're always investing money into these things and experiencing these things and talking about these things. Other people love these things. And so we decided to jump into the podcast arena and really just throw our hat in the game and try it out. So we're about to release chapter 4 in the next day or so. Definitely pumped about that. We're talking about a retro video game from 1994. And so if anybody wants to check it out, we're at Geek Ketchup Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And you can look up just Geek Ketchup Podcast on Facebook. And we're on all the major podcasting platforms in case anybody's interested. You know, we do circle topics, you know, because we do hit a bunch, but we'll always come back to things. So if there's not something that that maybe somebody's interested in right now, definitely keep an eye out, because there's a good chance that we'll touch on it at some point in the future.
Oh yeah, I mean, even in your episodes that you have now, you cover so many different things, and like, I've learned about some things listening to it that I didn't know about, and then I've listened to some things that you guys talk about that I do know about. So it's really exciting, because it's such a broad topic, but it's something that everyone can find their place in it and listen to what they're interested in and maybe find something else that they could be interested in that they didn't know about.
Exactly. And that right there, I'm so glad you said it, because that really is the definition of our goal, I guess, you know, is, you know, can we bring things to folks that have not experienced them, and then vice versa, you know, hopefully as our listener base grows and stuff like that, is can our listeners bring things to us that we aren't so experienced with? Because the world of geekery is huge. Everything, you know, under the sun can fit into it, you know, and it's just really about having fun. So we have fun with doing it. We're hoping that other people are having fun listening. You know, hopefully we'll get to keep it going for a good couple months at least.
Oh yeah, you can definitely tell that you guys are having fun. So I guess that's it. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me on.
Talking about this show with me. It's fun to hear different people's perspectives. And I like that you've read all the books and you started in the beginning, so you saw the whole culmination of it. And that's a nice perspective to have.
Yeah, it was definitely a journey. I remember for a while there when Game of Thrones seasons would hit, it was a little frustrating because, you know, once I had finished all the books and everybody, close friends and stuff, knew that I had done that, they were constantly asking me questions, right? Like, what did this mean? Who's that?
Oh.
And I try to do good in general about not spoiling things for people, but especially with a show like this where there are huge plot twists and reveals and things like that, you know, my wife and some of my closest friends would get so frustrated with me because I wouldn't answer their questions. And you know, like my wife, she'd be like, I'm asking you, it's okay, you can tell me. And I'd be like, yeah, but I like it too much to ruin it for you, you know. So I got to kind of sit back and watch people's, you know, jaws drop or them get mad or whatever, and it was fun. So anytime I can go back and check it out and, you know, get to experience it, I'm totally cool with it. So
oh yeah, definitely. I'll definitely have you back. We'll talk about more episodes. You can see how my stuff's changed and things have progressed.
That's what I'm interested in. You as a new person, how do you react to things as some of the bigger moments happen in front of you, you know, that you haven't gotten to yet?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, definitely. I know there's gonna be crazy things, and we'll do later ones and we can talk about those. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yay.
Thank you so much for listening. I will be back in a fortnight with a new episode, but be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any. While you're on that page to subscribe, if you guys could write a review or even just tell a friend about the show, that would be really awesome. I mean, everyone has already seen Game of Thrones besides me, so, you know, they'd probably like this, all right? You can follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Game of Groans Pod. There's also a Facebook page, Game of Groans Podcast, and the website is www.gameofgroanspod.com. Game of Groans was created, hosted, edited, and produced by Emily Bateman, and the music is by Simon Dom.